Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the audience and of the public. Tonight, we are holding our regular meeting Thursday, January 7th, 2016, at the Veterans Hall. We have a quorum here, and I'd like to have a moment of silence right now. And then, Neil, can you lead us to the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Everybody ready? Again, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, now we'd like to do some announcements. Gene, I'd like you to start. Do you have anything to say?
Winter's here, El Nino's here. Make sure your pennant lines are tied and more, whatever it takes to secure your boats.
Alan?
No announcements.
Lynn? I have one. It's on the agenda here. We have the 2016 goal setting meeting for the Friends of the Morro Bay Harbor Department. Lynn was kind enough to allow us the utilization of the Yacht Club on January 21st, 2016 at 6 p.m. We've had a successful first year and with several outreach events and a web page that we've developed. And we made a great profit from our movie at the Rock, which we were able to purchase some equipment for the Harbor Department. Eric will discuss that in the staff meeting. I'd like to have everyone who would be interested in being a friend of the Morro Bay Harbor Department to come to the meeting to discuss this new year and get involved. Thank you. Neil?
No comment.
Dana? Ron?
I like being a member of the Friends of the Morro Bay Harbor Department. It's gratifying. You can do as little or as much as you'd like, and every little bit helps, so that's a good thing. In addition to Gene's reminder to, sounded like mostly the mooring folks, I'd like to, speaking from personal experience 3 days ago, I'd like to remind everybody to check your bilge pumps. There's fortunately a lot of water coming out of the sky, and I wondered why my boat looked a little different in its trim. So check your bilge pumps.
Thank you, Ron. Okay, nothing else here. I'd like to have everyone, actually we have public comment right now. And any members of the public that would like to discuss anything that's not on our agenda, please come up right now. Sir? Please state your name.
I'm Don Double D. A lot of you might know me. I do a lot of events in town. I've been here about 45 years now, so been around a while. Tonight I'm wearing a Harbor Festival hat. I will be the executive director again for 2016 for the Harbor Festival, something I enjoy doing. As you know, this last year we totally reinvented it. I think we finally got it right for a change. We've got it where we have no admission. We're relying a lot on sponsor support. We've partnered with the city, with the tourism board, and with the Harbor Department, and it's been very successful. We only have Morro Bay vendors, businesses. We aren't bringing in out-of-town businesses, and it's been very successful for a lot of the businesses on the Embarcadero. We also have invited all the different fishing groups to participate and sell their wares and have them available to the public. So it turned out to be a really pretty special event. So we'd like to thank you for your help and your participation last year and ask you to participate again next year in a similar way. I want to thank John Solo and Johnny Biagini for their 4 years of running the festival. And Paul Nagy, who worked last year as a worker on the board of directors. All three of those have stepped down from the board of directors. So we have three vacancies on our board. And we're looking for some support and some membership to get in and help us on the board level. It is a working board, so it's not one of those things where you just come in and sit in meetings. We have a lot of work to do. We are also looking for a sponsor coordinator, someone to help us solicit sponsors. That's really all I came down to tell you, and we're going to try to do the same thing again next year. We'll be working with Eric, and if you guys have any input or any desire to go beyond where we were last year, please let me know. Thank you very much.
Hey, Don, real quick, on the economic front, do you have a – did you make a profit or – how did that work?
There were proceeds left over, and the proceeds were donated to the Maritime Museum Association. We had a little over $10,000. We rolled some of that in to get us started for this next year. We're pretty much all volunteer. We do have a little office help, and we do have an office and a phone and some of those expenses. But we were able to turn over $10,000 to the Maritime Museum Association.
Good.
And we would do the same thing again this year, maybe a different recipient. We will see where that goes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Don. Pardon me? Yeah, Dana?
Hey, Don. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the first annual Harbor Cup, Harbor Fest Cup. I thought that was a good event,
seeing
sailing going on during the Harbor Fest as part of the whole event.
Well, that's the kind of thing we want to do. We want to showcase what we do in our harbor and what we can do in our harbor. And things for people to come to town and watch and enjoy and educate them on what's going on here. So that was a wonderful event, and thank you for being involved in that. And other things that the Harbor Department did. And we'd like to see you do some more things this next year, maybe get out and rescue somebody or something. Good
evening. Okay. Okay. Right now, we want to go to A1, approval of minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting held on December 3rd, 2015. Has everyone had a chance to look at those? Any comments? Any corrections? Do I hear a motion to approve?
Yeah, I move to approve.
Okay, Alan?
Yeah.
I hear a second.
I'll second.
Gene? Alan has approved it. Gene has seconded it. All in favor? Well, any discussion first? None? All in favor? Aye. All opposed? Okay. Minutes are approved. Public hearings, reports, and appearances. The Harbor Department status report. Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to this somewhat rare January meeting. As you know, we've normally not had January meetings, but back in December we didn't cancel, I think because we've got a lot of work to do, and because January, the first Thursday, fell a little later in the month, unlike past years where it's been so close to the first. So welcome to a January meeting. I'm going to skip to the third item on my status report and kind of piggyback on what Gene brought up earlier this evening about El Nino. Unless you don't have a pulse, you may have realized that the ocean has been alive the last couple days with storm activity and huge surf. The Coast Guard, the third item on here, this winter, the United States Coast Guard has established a special safety zone in the Morro Bay Harbor entrance area where they now have authority granted from Coast Guard Long Beach to stop vessel traffic from entering or leaving Morro Bay Harbor during certain conditions, those being hazardous bar days when the surf's big, large breaking waves as we've had in the last few days. Ports north of here, that's a fairly typical authority for them to be able to stop vessel traffic up until this recent safety zone establishment was implemented. They didn't have that authority, and if folks chose to go out in conditions like we saw today, really didn't have the authority to stop them. Well, now they do. And on December 7th, fishing vessel Golden Chalice, which is a large visiting boat, was wanting to come into Morro Bay Harbor during 18 to 20-foot surf here in the harbor entrance. Big fishing boat, big slow fishing boat, and the Coast Guard was able to exercise that authority and say, you start with a recommendation. You know, we really recommend you don't try. But if they need to, they can exercise that authority and keep those vessels from coming or going in the Golden Chalice. Fortunately, did decide to go down. I think they went offshore a little further and just dodged offshore overnight until the surf subsided overnight. So just want mariners to be aware that, as Gene says, winter's here and we've got a real winter again. We had 18, 20, 25-foot breaking surf out in front of our harbor entrance today. We had probably two true rescues of surfers inside the harbor entrance, a couple of assists, a couple of preventive actions. We had a guy about 2 o'clock decide he wanted to go inner tubing on the north side of the rock. He was tethered to his inner tube. You'll probably see it on YouTube because he had a GoPro camera, and I suspect he's going to post it. He was out there having fun. He wasn't in trouble. But had he gotten separated from his inner tube or had he gotten swept out beyond the breakers, he was kind of close to the rock at that outlet area where you get recirculated around and around. He got recirculated around about 10 times. We finally put a couple of rescue swimmers in, Kyle Schaefer from our lifeguard cadre and Jeff Simpson from Orbe Fire, suited up and went in and assisted him on in. He was having trouble getting, either all the way in or over to shore, even though he wasn't yelling for help. And when we got to him, he claimed he didn't need help. But given he was going around and around and around and eventually would have gotten separated from his inner tube, we elected to go make a sort of a forced rescue and bring him out of the water, which we did, and fortunately it turned well. We had another incident right on the heels of that where two surfers on the inside of the North Jetty were surfing together. Surfer number one was kind of getting out towards the end of the North Jetty. Strong outgoing ebb tide right now in the afternoons, where if you get out into that channel just beyond where people surf there on the inside of the North Jetty, you're going to get swept out the entrance unless you're an Olympic swimmer or an Olympic paddler. And this fellow saw his buddy getting pulled out, so he started paddling out after him. He lost sight of his buddy right out at the entrance where the green channel marker is. Couldn't see him anymore. He started getting swept out, couldn't paddle against it to paddle back in. He paddled into the North Jetty, climbed up on the rocks, whether he climbed up all the way under the top to try and see his buddy or whether he thought that was the best place to be, he climbed up onto the top of the rocks where he was very quickly knocked off by a huge wave. Onto the inside, fortunately landed on a surfboard, minor injuries, and then was able to scramble into the rocks back into the beach. While the Coast Guard was standing by, on the inside of the harbor, kind of waiting to see what was happening with our inner tube guy, this was just starting to occur, and all the Coast Guard saw was a blue surfboard float by with nobody attached to it, and that, of course, set off all the alarm bells. We all finished up with the inner tube guy, rushed over to the other side. Everybody spread out and started looking, and fortunately found the fellow who lost the board because he had walked back in. His buddy had managed to paddle across the harbor entrance to the South Jetty and then got pushed by whitewater into the inside of the harbor on the south side over there. So fortunately, both of those ended well, including the inner tuber. But just a reminder that the ocean is alive, the ocean is powerful, and three people that we pulled out of the water today, they all claimed, I've been surfing for X number of years, I've been doing this, I've been doing that, I know what I'm doing. But it just takes a moment between you know what you're doing to your dead. So people just need to be cautious. Don't go in above your head. Don't go in beyond your abilities. Talk to the harbor department, talk to the Coast Guard, look and see what's going on. That current today was just vicious. It's flowing out six, eight knots out through the narrows there, right on the south side of the rock. And we had 6, 8, 10-foot standing waves there that we're trying to maneuver our harbor patrol boat through and the Coast Guard through with these boogie boarders and surfers and stand-up paddlers all trying to get mixed up in there. And it's just a bad place to be. So folks just need to be aware, observe what's going on, and take a little more time before you jump out and go get in the water and see what's happening. So
one surfer came in and said, thank you for saving my life.
Yeah, one of the guys, I guess, came back to our office and said, thanks for saving my life. Not sure which one it was, but a lot of stuff happening today. So people just be aware out there. And folks that want to go out and view those waves that go out to the North Jetty on the south side of the rock, stay back. Waves, if you're not used to how surf works, you see waves of a certain size coming in every 10, 15, 20, can be 30 minutes apart. A set will come in 1.5 times as large as the waves that have been coming in, and all of a sudden you're in a spot that what you thought was dry, and now you're in neck deep in water. And we've pulled a number of people out of there that get swept out of that area on the base of the North Jetty. So stay back from that North Jetty area. Don't go walking out beyond the parking lot out into the rocks. Number one, you've got a lot of rock fall from above. If you stand there at the base of the rock, kind of at the North Jetty, and long enough, you'll start to see things starting to drop down, little bits of rock and sand drop down, because the rock's eroding, and there's constantly things falling off. So you got a hazard from above, and you got a hazard in front. So just folks just need to be aware that those places just are not places to be. Get back and enjoy from a distance.
Gene?
Yeah, I want to follow up on what Eric said. This morning, I was down at the rock by the changing room, just sitting looking at the surf in my car, and a big set came. This is high tide. Set wave came, broke over the jetty, out onto the parking lot where the benches are, clear water over the benches, water up to my car, and drug everything back. So you just got to be careful out there.
And earlier this morning, if you're familiar with the rock and you go out and you want to go walk on the beach and you go to kind of the east end of the lot where we have our beach access ramp, you go there now and there's a 6-foot berm because all the sand's been eroded away. And when waves come in, sets of waves come in, all that energy and all that water comes in and concentrates in that corner area. And this morning I was watching a family that were sitting back up on the dunes in their camping chairs, but their kids were down playing on that eroded away berm, and it was fortunate the tide was going out. Had it been a little early in the day, or every once in a while a big set will come out of nowhere and all that water washes into that corner and then works its way out along the rocks out towards where the power plant outfall is. And little kids, you know, they're 3 feet tall, 2 feet of water is over their heads, and they get swept out in that and they're done and they're washed out and there's no, you just can't get to them. So people just need to be super aware that there's just a lot of dynamics going on out there, and just be careful.
Thank you, Eric.
Yep. So I'll get off my soapbox on that, my public safety soapbox. Recent Harbor Patrol activity, our department activity, we participated with the Coast Guard in some hazmat and oil boom deployment training here on December 9th, just to keep us in tune. Unfortunately, we've had a couple spills there over the last few months where we've actually had to deploy things down at the fuel dock, the old fuel dock. Bayfront Marina down at the south end of town, but we're pretty much constantly trying to train with the Coast Guard and have us all coordinate together so when real incidents do occur, we're coordinated in our activities. Our Harbor Patrol vessel 6-8, our 27-foot Radden built in 84 that everyone's probably pretty familiar with, been around quite a few years. It's seen a lot. We put two new engines in it recently from a grant from Boating and Waterways. And we did a significant amount of structural and cosmetic refurbishment work, mostly done in-house by our own patrol officers, Jeremiah Jacobs, primarily heading it up, and Dana Stein. You notice a nice new paint job on it. Did, like I say, a lot of structural work. Cleaned it all up, fixed it up. We got two new engines in it. So hopefully that boat will be good for another 2 to 4 years until we can start funding really to replace it and get another good modern twin-engine boat in the fleet, and then we'll retire that boat. So that's the eventual plan here in the longer term. Friends of the Harbor Department, as Bill said earlier, attachment to the staff report, we purchased some equipment from funds brought forward by the Friends, mainly I think from the movie night we had back in November, great success for that. We got a new beach wheelchair for handicapped folks to have handicapped access to the beach that we loan out. Check it out at the Harbor Department if you want to use it. We allow it pretty much anywhere here in Morro Bay. Sometimes it travels a little further, but we like to keep it here in Morro Bay, so we add that one to the one we already have, so now we have two. Pretty darn popular thing, especially in the summertime. A lot of folks are using that. And then a couple new rescue boards that we purchased from, rescue training boards that we purchased from the Friends funding that went to the Junior Lifeguard program. So they've got two new boards for that program. So we thank the Friends for all the hard work they do. And then again on January 21st, as Bill said, we've got at the Morro Bay Yacht Club, 6 p.m., right?
That's correct.
They're going to do a little goal-setting work there, so we look forward to what comes out of the Friends next year. Coast Guard Safety Zone, we talked about that. recent City Council action at the December 8th meeting, they approved two new license agreements, one for Great American Fish Company and one for Harbor Hut Restaurant to store their trash recycle and grease recycling needs over by in the Front Street parking lot, kind of where the lift station is and where our Harbor oil recycling yard is. Those enclosures were built many years ago, but never really had any official city sanction for it to be there in terms of a license agreement or lease or anything, so we established a lease and put that in place, so that's new. Also, the December 8th meeting, the lease site for the SALT building, lease site 6566, previously owned by Abba Mani, was approved for sale to Rick and Terry Gamble, their local developers, proposing to maintain that lease site and that building in its current condition and do some upgrades on it. So we look forward to Rick and Terry being new tenants. In fishery news, although things have changed a little bit, recreational Dungeness crab and rock crab season did open. Fish and Game opened that. However, they're leaving the commercial rock crab and Dungeness crab season closed. They've still got some testing for domoic acid, which is a naturally occurring toxin in plankton that affects crab meat and also affects sardines and anchovies and other little critters like that. They continue, they've been testing up and down the coast. I think the only areas that are still testing bad are around the Channel Islands and somewhere in extreme northern California. But from my understanding, the Dungeness crab commercial season, they're keeping it closed because they don't want to open it piecemeal because then everybody will descend on smaller areas and have an adverse effect on the crab. So unfortunately, they're having to leave everything closed, which really shuts down on their season. It was supposed to have opened November 1, so they've lost 2 months already. Obviously, the weather's probably going to have an effect or would have had an effect as well, but it's unfortunate that our crabbers aren't able to get out there. But hopefully that ends soon, they'll be able to get out. Morbi National Estuary Program Executive Director, or former director, I guess as of December 31st, Adrienne Harris stepped down. As you know, she's a new mother, and she wishes to fully dedicate herself to that new role. So she stepped down from the Morbi National Estuary Program. And Lexi Bell, who is the assistant to the executive director, will be replacing Adrienne. So we want to thank Adrienne for her many years of service and welcome Lexi here to the helm and look forward to seeing those folks and the great work they do. Upcoming events, Morbi Winter Bird Festival in its 20th year, hopefully I got that right, runs January 15th to the 18th. Our ecotourism event, annual tourism event, promotes understanding, appreciation of birds and other wildlife. They've got events not just in Morro Bay, but up and down the county's coast, lots of field trips out in the field to do different stuff. They got a good website, morrobaybirdfestival.org. You can go there for details and see what sort of great events they have coming up, going on there. Past events, the Tall Ship Lady Washington was here at Marina Square December 1st through 8th. I think they came a day earlier than anticipated. Maybe they had fair winds when they sailed up or down the coast. But they got here a day early, and then they left a day late because the day they wanted to leave, the harbor entrance wasn't too good. So they elected to stay in harbor one extra day. So we got an extra day of the boat being here. So we look forward to seeing them again next time. The holiday light of boat parade hadn't occurred when I wrote the staff report, but obviously this has occurred now. It was on December 5th, had great weather, good participation. A lot of folks on the waterfront. I don't think I've ever seen a line of cars take as long as it did to get from the rock on out of town when the parade was over. It seemed like a good 45 minutes. It was all taillights and headlights from Coleman Beach on out to the rock because it was so crowded out there. So that was a great event. And anticipation of El Nino storms, December 9th and 10th, city's public works, fire, harbor, administrative, and other crews got together, a city manager, got together and did a pretty comprehensive job of going through Morro Creek and cleaning out all the debris and detritus and just leftover stuff from all the homeless camps that have been in there over the years. The main drive or the main reason was all the trash and human waste and all the things in there. That creek is going to flow this year if the winter keeps up the way it is, and all that stuff would end up on the beach and in the ocean if we didn't get in there. So we went in. The police department did a great job of putting out noticing months in advance for folks to clear their stuff out and to take anything that they wanted to keep. Crews went in and identified anything what could be considered personal belongings. It's being stored by the police department over at the city's corporate yard for if folks want to go claim it. And then everything else that was trash was loaded up in the dumpsters. Over 200 cubic yards of trash and debris removed. If you think of your standard big rollaway dumpster that shows up at a construction site that's what, maybe 15 feet long by 6 feet high and 5 or 6 feet wide, that's a 40-yard dumpster. So we carried away over 200 yards of debris out of there. Dynegy, the power plant owner, was a large landowner of that area back there that had a lot of those camps and a lot of that debris, so they contributed a significant amount of funding towards that effort as well. But we're glad that we got it out when we did, because it looks like hopefully sometime soon that creek's going to be flowing. Also on that tally of things found, you can imagine what was there, but over 30 used hypodermic needles and other paraphernalia, so a lot of stuff that shouldn't be in there and definitely didn't want to be on our beaches, we were able to pull it out. Still in the future, as of writing this staff report, but again, has occurred by now, will be the has occurred as a polar bear dip at Cayucas Pier. High noon, I think that event seems to grow a little bit every year. Seems to get a little wilder and crazier every year where people, it's turned into a real costume event now. I think previously it had just been, you know, people just going out and taking a jump in the water and getting back out, but now it seems to be a crazy costume event with people dressing up as everything from cars to ghouls to everything under the sun. You see some crazy costumes out there. We send a boat, and we usually send some lifeguards and a jet ski out there to stand by, because traditionally, I don't know if anybody swam this year, but in years past, folks have swam out around the pier. And if you're swimming out in the pier and the water's 52, 53 degrees, and you're in your bathing suit, a lot of those folks didn't fare too well and need to be pulled out of the water, so we usually stand by. And some years can have big surf, and it can tumble people like bowling pins in there, so we stand by, as does Cal Fire and Cayucas Fire, and really kind of treat it as a training drill, sort of an interagency cooperation training deal. But fortunately, I don't think there are any major incidents this year, but great event. And finally, again, not passed as of the writing of the staff report, but passed as of last night here at the Vets Hall from 6 to, actually probably went to about 9:30, 9:45. The City of Morro Bay's City Council invited NOAA Marine Sanctuary folks to come to Morro Bay to give sort of a Sanctuary 101 meeting, whereby the community and other folks could learn about what sanctuaries are, what they do, and where the Chumash Heritage proposal, which has been accepted for nomination, is on the inventory list, and how that proposal may move forward, if it does move forward. So they gave about an hour-long presentation in PowerPoint, and then opened up some Q&A, and then had many tables around the room where staff from the Channel Island Sanctuary, the Monterey Sanctuary, and then the regional office were all here answering questions. So that meeting had, this room was, we had about as, we had a couple tables set up at this end, so we had maybe 15 feet of the room here opened up, but everywhere else back into the meeting room was as full as we could get with chairs, including over into the side room. I think somebody counted over 250 chairs, and we had people standing wall to wall around the perimeter here, so 250, 275 people, one of the most heavily attended meetings ever, so good turnout there, and hopefully folks got some good information. And again, the one attachment for the Coast Guard safety zone. Hopefully they don't ever have to use it, but if they do have to enforce that rule on you and somebody insists they want to try and transit the harbor area and the Coast Guard says, no, you shall not, it's a potential $40,000 fine for each violation. Again, hopefully they don't do that, but that's the hammer they do have in case folks do want to try and violate that. Neil?
Do they post when... is when the rough bar lights are on, is that when it's in effect, or what's the notification for the public?
Yeah, typically what you're going to see is the rough bar lights. They do also post, make announcements on the radio on Marine Channel 16 on a regular basis that the safety zone's been established. There could be days when the hazardous bar lights are on, but the safety zone isn't in effect, depending on conditions. If it's a day where, yeah, it's still hazardous, but it's passable, my guess is there's not going to be a lot of those days because it's hazardous. Generally means it's starting to get impassable, but there's a possibility there, so you really need to listen to the radio and or call the Harbor Department or call the Harbor Patrol, and we can tell you what the conditions are. But if you're on the water and you don't have any of that and you see those flashing yellowish-orange lights on the end of the North T Pier, you need to start thinking that something may not be right.
Ron? I just noticed a closer reading of this notice from the Coast Guard regarding the safety zone, that if you decide you can afford the $40,000 fine, it is apparently a Class D felony. So they're pretty serious about this.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, our jobs, you know, obviously we got into this business, Harbor Patrol and Coast Guard, public safety to help safety and rescue, but there's times when our lives get unnecessarily put in danger, and that's the idea, is that, hey, if you're going to do something that we're telling you, you know, it just isn't a good situation, yeah, we're going to hit you with a hammer. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Any other questions for Eric? Alan?
Just one question. In view of the severity of the penalty and also the accident you could have, is there any way we could have some more, like a flag or something that was just, you absolutely couldn't miss it if the bar was closed?
That would be up to the Coast Guard. I can certainly ask. Like I said, they've got that large yellow sign with the flashing yellow lights.
Have you ever run into somebody who didn't know that it was closed when it was closed? Didn't see the sign, didn't see the lights?
Yeah, well, yeah, Polly's whispering in my ear here. Yeah, we had a guy this morning that was in his little inflatable skiff. He wasn't intending to go out. He just wanted to go look at it. Got out of the narrows when where the current was going 6-8 knots, and luckily we went out and approached him and told him to get out of there. He went and had a chat with the Coast Guard afterwards. He had his engine full throttle, a little aluminum boat, and was barely making way against the tide. So if his engine would have sputtered and died, out he goes, out to the harbor engine. So, I think intentionally, whether he looked or not, he was just going out there regardless. But yeah, I can say there's been times in the past where we've had boaters go by, probably recreational boaters that aren't necessarily Morro Bay residents that may not know per se. But yeah, there's been days when those lights have been flashing and boats have gone right by and either ignored it or just don't know what it is.
I don't know what you'd do about that, but it just seems difficult to me. I certainly wouldn't want to get hit with a double whammy.
Right. Lynn?
Yes, following up on that same question is when that hazardous bar warning is dropped. At the yacht club, we get a call when it's posted, but we never get a call when it's dropped. So we, other than every time a boat wants to go out, calling either you or the Coast Guard to find out the status, there's no other way to do it. And that could become somewhat onerous.
We do have a protocol within our department that when the bar warning goes up, we notify all the passenger for hires, the Verges, the Patriots, all the kayak rental places, because they've potentially got folks that may not know what's going on, and the yacht club's also on that list, and we do our best to try and call everybody when the bar warning goes down. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. We definitely want to try and make it when it goes up. It goes down as well, because we know, folks like Verges and others, they'll cancel trips if it's posted, and they need to know somewhat in advance when people have bought tickets. So we're working and exploring on potentially something on the city's website, the Notify Me, or some other automatic means by which we can do more of a one-touch button notification and program who it all goes out to so that we can, I don't want to call it reverse 911, but a similar system to where we can make it easier for our staff to get the notice out to everybody in a more timely fashion. So that's our aim, and hopefully we can get that implemented sometime in the near future.
That would be a very good idea. Thank you.
Gene?
In 83-84, the harbor mouth was closed for 45 days straight.
83-84? And who closed it, Gene? Okay. Yeah, Neil?
The other thing just to notice that on that map, the zone actually begins before Target Rock, so that it's not at the mouth of the harbor. The zone, you could be in a finable zone well before Target Rock, just as the sand takes basically a bend to the west.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, Neil. So, yeah, you can see that shaded area. It's kind of the Target Rock and the Narrows in there where we pulled three people out today. That's one of the worst spots, especially for small, although it doesn't apply necessarily, this doesn't apply to surface, although maybe make a closer read and see. We actually discussed this with the Coast Guard a little bit today. That narrow area in there, if a boat like the one we had this morning, if his engine sputtered, it's a matter of 15, 20, 30 seconds by the time he's, in the narrows there off the little inner groin jetty to the harbor entrance where nobody can get him. So that's why they established it to that larger area to where once you're kind of back behind channel marker number 8 and east of Target Rock, there's not that high current flow. But once you get in that narrows, it's kind of like, a little fire hose going through there. You just get shot through, and then you get the standing, especially the tide's going out, and you get the standing wave on a big swell. You can get knocked off, swamped. I mean, it's like a river wave in there, and it's a whole different dynamic, and people just don't belong in there on any kind of craft unless they're there for a very specific purpose, which there really isn't one.
Well, the sightseeing boats, a lot of them go up to as far as Target Rock, just to get a look, and
right.
Just be nice to probably educate them to make sure that they know that they're in a possible fine situation.
Yep.
Okay, Alan?
I'm just curious, is there any policy between you and the Coast Guard of keeping any kind of a daylight watch on the harbor entrance to see if people are getting in trouble? I mean,
we do on days like today, and when the bar's posted, keep abreast of what the tide's doing, what the swells are doing, because it's become so popular in there for surfing, like what happened today, and even kayaking, people against the South Jetty as well. It is pretty much our policy and our attempt to try and get out there as much as we can, especially stand by in a boat. Times today, I mean, there are times when our boat shouldn't have been out there. It gets rough enough to where that standing wave poses a danger even to us and the Coast Guard. So we've got to be mindful of that. But we do monitor that very diligently and very regularly and see what the tide's doing. Like today when the tide turned about 3, 3:15, you can kind of let your guard down because now you know that tide's not ripping out. If a boogie boarder or a surfer loses his board in there now inside the North Jetty, he's not going to get swept out. He's going to get pushed on into the beach. It would be more normal beach situation. So we let our guard down a little bit. But we're out there pretty diligently. We go out to the north side of the rock for the folks that are walking out there and trying to get too close to the North Jetty, us in state parks. So, yeah, and Coast Guard's out there on a regular basis. They go out every morning when they know the surf's big, really at first light, to get a good handle on what the situation is. They'll go out at last light and do regular patrols out there as well to see what's going on, both by land and by sea, and again, keep abreast of it. So, yeah, we're out there pretty regular.
One question, and as a policy, people are surfing inner tubing today, as you stated. Do you have a policy that they can't do it? I mean, is it's to their risk? I mean, what is the policy that the city has? I mean,
outside of this Coast Guard safety zone that they can enforce upon, the only authority we have in terms of coming in and out of the harbor after the San Mateo incident in 1983, this California legislature granted the Morro Bay Harbor Patrol the authority to restrict passenger for hire boats, the Verges and the Patriot sport fishing boats, from entering or leaving the harbor in hazardous harbor entrance conditions. I can probably say with pretty affirmatively that we've never had to exercise it. We may have threatened it to keep boats from coming or going, maybe when they're wanting to go out. But I don't think we have actually had to exercise it and enforce upon that authority. Coast Guard, again, hopefully they won't have to enforce on the safety zone. But beyond that, no. If somebody, guy wants to go inner tubing in the north side of the rock, unless any municipality, any jurisdiction does have the ability to close off a public area in an emergency type situation and restrict people from entering that area, be it a fire or whatever, if they deem that necessary. Short of that, no. If you want to go out inner tubing in Morro Rock, you can do it. There are laws on the books that if it's considered a frivolous rescue or a frivolous incident that you've created because of something you shouldn't have done, like climbing Morro Rock, we can charge for all the responders and all the costs that are associated with that. So, yeah, there is that. But a guy going out on an inner tube, it would be a court-type thing you'd need to get into to enforce upon that. And so, no, we can't stop surfers from surfing.
Hearing no other questions, let's go down to our business items. Thank you, Eric, very much. The first one, C1, update from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee. Dana?
Thank you. I spent some time going through all the activities we did last year, the Ad Hoc Committee, and there was quite a bit. I must say I hope that we can continue on with the same momentum or more. We got to the point where we, after coming up with some site criteria and then bringing that to the Harbor Advisory Board, and the Harbor Advisory Board seeing our recommendation for the Triangle Lot, voted unanimously for that and to recommend that to the City Council. That was in June. And then we went on, the council allocated $15,000 for a mini master plan. And that was brought on by, or that was awarded to RRM, which came in under 10, I believe. And we presented that site plan, that whole perspective last meeting, which I thought went really well. Towards the end of it, I didn't adequately answer the issue of traffic control or traffic issues with the trailer traffic as far as the stored boats on the storage area. And I just wanted to say that this is not an area where you're going to see trucks coming in or cars or whatever and taking these trailers out unless they're leaving. But if they're taking them over to the jib crane, they're going to be using mules, which is an electric-powered dolly. Picks up the tongue of the boat, and you walk with it over there. So you're going to be walking from the storage yard over to the jib crane, which would be located on a wider section of the travel lift ways, according to the drawings that we have right now. So this takes about 5 minutes probably to do. And then once you get there, you'll unload the boat off the trailer and take the trailer back. And so the traffic's going to be quite slow. Maybe there'll be two mules, but you're not going to have a lot of
trailer traffic.
I'm sorry?
The trailer traffic
will be very slow. I mean, it's not going to be, and you're not going to have vehicles involved, so that helps a lot. I have a great video of this at Santa Barbara Yacht Club on a Wednesday afternoon where they just launch boats and go racing. Unfortunately, to show it on the screen, it comes in sideways, so you can't really see it. And oh, very good. That will save.
So this is a video
you from having to listen to me explain it. Yeah, this is in Santa Barbara Harbor. This is on a Wednesday afternoon. This is how the recreational racers. Commonly, Wednesday is another race day besides the weekend. And these guys will come down a little bit early, cut out of work. And this is, I hope you can see that. There's a person walking in front of that trailer with that boat on it. And they just have a dolly that, what we call a mule, which is about the size of a lawnmower. And you can easily just wind that thing around all over the place. And there's the harbor office. So he's going to turn it and come down the pier here to the jib crane. It's just one person handling this. It works pretty well.
Dana?
Yes?
How big is that boat?
That's a J-24.
Thank you.
Probably one of the largest fleets you'll find racing. So there's... What's that? Oh, that's not the right... Okay. So anyways, that kind of explains how that traffic would look. They come in, they get over to the crane. There's another one. It's not this one, but there's another video that shows it actually being dropped in the water, and it's very simply done. Here they actually, his crew climbs down the ladder and hops in the boat, throws the lines off, and they just, what we call, walk it over by just kind of shifting their weight on a small boat like this right over to a dock. Of course, what we plan on doing is having a dock where they can actually tie up to, a gangway they come down to. You can bring a dock cart, load the boat up, passengers get on, and then you take off. But anyways, that kind of helps explain part of a facility that we're looking at that is unknown in this harbor. We don't have anything like that. And that would help the recreational sailors quite a bit. I mean, I think you would see a fleet grow here of ocean racing just from that, because they would have access to the water that they don't have now. To do that down at the launch ramp takes all day long. And you bog, you got to have a tongue extension to get that boat in the water because you have so much depth. And you're not very likely to pop it back out of the water and put it away afterwards. You're probably going to leave it in.
Yes.
How large a boat could be handled on this jib crane and with your mule?
Well, you know, we can spec that to different. What we've looked at, we're pretty much looking at 30 foot and under. Like Olsen 30s, I brought in a couple years ago, I brought in a photograph of Santa Cruz Yacht Club's yard that they have with a crane right there pretty close to it. And if you look in their yard, they have Olsen 30s on down. So that's a pretty good fleet of boats. Yeah.
Gene?
Dana, do you think the recreational sailboating is in compliance with Measure D in that area?
Well, that's a good question. I think we're piggybacking on the whole commercial fishing, them using all of this stuff. I mean, the boat yard, everything else. I don't think that should keep a recreational boater from using the travel lift and hauling out and going in the boat yard either. The Measure D is the way it's worded, and then the way it's been handled are two different things. But I would hope that this is not a problem.
Yeah,
Alan?
We really would like to have a boat yard in the harbor, and we can't see having a boat yard without serving the entire community, and it seems like the logical place to put it would be in the Measure D area. On the other hand, I've had been suggested that we put the boat yard down by the launch ramp, and then you run into the opposite argument. You know, how can you have that down at in an area that's not Measure D? So one way or another, it seems like you have to play both sides against the middle on that rule.
Yeah, I would say we've gotten this far with going over this and over this to where we've gotten a site, we've recommended the site, we've gotten money to do a study or a proposal of a mini master plan, and for these issues to come up now about where the site should be seem pretty late in the game. I remember a few years ago there was issues down where the one boat yard that we do have exists, and they were saying no commercial here. They were trying to get rid of any commercial. That whole neighborhood was adamant about any commercial activity whatsoever. And I actually came and spoke against that. I said, hey, this is a small bay. I don't know why you'd want to tie your hands of anything here right now. I mean, they were saying that oil platforms were going to be coming out here and that the crew boats were going to be parked here and on and on. So this is in an industrial area, a power plant. I don't know if you can get too much more industrial than that with Measure D across the street. So if there's a better place, if anybody has another plan, please come talk to the ad hoc committee. It's kind of silly if we're sitting here doing this year after year and somebody else is working another plan that we don't know about. I would say please come talk to us. Let us know, because I don't want to sit here doing this if it's all for naught. Thank you.
Dana, one question is that in the last meeting, we had a recommendation of a plan. Where is that right now? Is that in the city's hoppers to have the city council review it? Or where are we now?
You would have to ask the city on that. I don't know.
Eric, do you? I mean, where are we in putting that in the hopper for the city council to look at?
It's not scheduled, to my knowledge, for any council hearing in the immediate future, meaning probably up into the summer. I know it's on the radar screen for possible review, but I don't think we're intending to look at it anytime in the near future.
Well, so you're saying, okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah, Alan?
I spoke with Eric in his office the other day about that, and he said that the city is waiting to finish the promenade process to see how many parking places they need, and at that point they'll have a better idea of whether they are willing to use the triangle lot for the boatyard or not. So that's kind of holding things up right now.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Well, okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions for Dana? Okay, C2, update from the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee on committee's recent activities. Neil?
I've met and spoke with Eric. At this point, I'd let him give a brief staff report. Take it away, Eric.
Thank you. So we're just starting to warm up to mid-year budget review, whereby we take a look back at the last 6 months from the beginning of our budget year in July 1st. I'll be having something hopefully over the next couple of weeks together to bring to the ad hoc committee in terms of our operating budget, capital improvement budget, reserves, equipment, capital equipment replacement, and whatnot, and starting to run some of that through the committee and starting to get their input as we go into mid-year budget. And then come March, we start working up to the actual budget for next year, so we'll be kind of dovetailing those together over the next month or two.
So the ad hoc committee didn't have a chance to meet with all the members together, but I believe each of us has individually spoken with Eric regarding this. Do you guys have anything else that you wanted to add at this point?
No. Ron?
And then that's it from us.
Okay. C3, update from the Eelgrass Ad Hoc Committee on committee's recent activities. Lynn?
Yes, we have met once. This committee was just established in the November meeting, meeting. So we met once, and that was Neil, myself, and Jean. And we established some goals, intermediate goals, of which goal one was to investigate eelgrass mitigation projects in Morro Bay, in the state of California, and any other national projects that may be going on. Number two is to become familiar with the Eelgrass Bank project in Newport Harbor. And number three is to become familiar with the research and study projects being planned or completed on how in Morro Bay we can best encourage the growth of eelgrass. We have not since then had any other meetings, but we do have one planned to get together with the NEP. Jen Nix, who is their eelgrass expert, so that we can start this educational process to figure out where these projects are and get the data on them so that we can start looking at it.
Yeah, Neil.
We've had some interest from people who want to become part of the ad hoc committee, whether members or advisors, and we're also going to look into, I believe, interviewing some people and see if that would be a good fit.
Yep. Jean, did you have anything to add?
Where we're putting the new docks in Morro Bay Landing, the pre-construction survey as compared to the post-construction survey, we have three times the amount of eelgrass as we had a year and a half ago in that area.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions for Lynn on eelgrass? Now, Lynn, I've gotten a chain of emails on some people that are interested in being on that committee, NEP being one, and I think Anchor, the gentleman, have you reached out to them?
At this point, we have not. We are starting our studies with educating ourselves on the information that is available. We will be talking to other people who are interested to see what kind of a fit will be between these various agencies and what role they may play and how they can most help us.
Okay. Thank you. And C4 is the update from the Marine Sanctuaries Ad Hoc Committee on committee's recent activities. Ron?
Need to ask the board's and the public's patience. This is going to take a little while. Our initial report is a little bit lengthy. The committee, and I'm going to read it, otherwise I couldn't possibly remember this stuff. The committee was formed last year for the purpose of educating itself and hence the Harbor Advisory Board and then the City Council that we serve, about the Federal National Marine Sanctuaries Act, as amended by Congress in the year 2000, and what the Act might mean for the provisions of the Act for a marine sanctuary, a hypothetical marine sanctuary, to be established off the coast of Morro Bay. The committee members, Alan Allward, Bill LaFay, and myself, have initially divided our efforts into three macro areas of interest as it relates to a hypothetical marine sanctuary off the coast of Morro Bay. Alan has taken on the potential regulatory nature of such a sanctuary. Bill has taken on the local and regional economic aspects of such a sanctuary, and I've taken on the local, regional, and state control issues relative to such a sanctuary. And just to be clear, that means that we're studying these things. I believe none of us would profess to have any professional background specifically as it relates to some of these issues, but we are studying it and will pass on to the board and hence to the City Council what we learn. This evening, each of us will provide the Harbor Advisory Board with a recap of our efforts to date. Last evening, committee members attended the informational public forum put on by National Marine Sanctuary Civil Service staffers under the auspices of the National Oceanographic Administration, known as NOAA. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, N-O-A-A, under which the National Marine Sanctuaries Program operates. The advertised purpose of the forum was for NOAA to inform the public regarding the nature of the National Marine Sanctuaries Act and the purpose and function of marine sanctuaries. Principal presenters were Mr. Bill Duros, West Coast Regional Director, NOAA Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, Ms. Lisa Wonick, Regional Policy Coordinator for West Coast Marine Sanctuaries, Paul Mitchell, Superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, and Chris Mobley, Superintendent of the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, and they brought additional staff people with them. Yesterday evening's NOAA forum appeared to present marine sanctuaries in a very positive light. During the forum, NOAA personnel clearly expressed their desire for a sanctuary to be established off the coast of Morro Bay, and for that sanctuary to extend from the southern boundary of the Monterey Bay Sanctuary, which is Cambria, if we didn't know, to the northern boundary of Channel Island Sanctuary, which is the Point Conception area not far to the west from Santa Barbara. The forum was televised and I believe will be available for some time on Channel 20. This morning, ad hoc committee members met with Mrs. Wonink and briefly with Mr. Duros. Each committee member asked a series of questions focused on their individual macro area of interest. The essence of those dialogues will be addressed in our individual committee member reports this evening. Alan will go first, then Bill, and then myself. Alan?
I had a little trouble with this. Seemed to have a case of writer's block. I had a meeting on the 3rd with the Fishermen's Organization over this, and then the meeting last night and the meeting this morning. I was reading the sanctuary that says they can regulate anything that they need to protect the resources of the sanctuary. When you look at what is a resource of the sanctuary, they have that in the definitions. It says sanctuary resource means any living or non-living resource of a national marine sanctuary that contributes to the conservation, recreational, ecological, historical, educational, cultural, archaeological, scientific, and aesthetic value of the sanctuary. Now, any regulations that they propose have to be within what's allowed in the designation document. they are allowed to propose regulations for fishing if, after applying to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, they do not act or do not act in a manner that they, the sanctuary believes is consistent with their guide, what they need to do to protect sanctuary. So them regulating fisheries is not what they want to do, what they necessarily are supposed to do, but it can happen. Now, in the designation document, they can say that they're not going to regulate fishings, and they have to stick to that. However, they can change the designation document. So there is some concern among the fishermen, and unfortunately, I'm wearing two hats here, so I have a tendency to be biased. So let's say that, okay? And I told you all that going into this, but we're concerned that any promise that they will not interfere with fishing may not is not a promise that's cast in stone. So other than that, regulations, anything going into the water, they have jurisdiction over. Anything that you take out of the water, they have jurisdiction over. There's a classic piece of literature that's being circulated against opponents talking about 4 cups of sand and the resulting 4 pages of permit that were required to take those 4 cups of sand out of sanctuary waters. I imagine that's probably an extreme example of things being regulated what most people would consider to be a little heavily. There are instances where sanctuaries have been allowed to regulate fishing, and they have no commercial fishing in the sanctuary. So that is a possibility. What we will see, we don't know yet. And that's about all I can say tonight.
Thank you. On the economic front, I don't have a lot of quantitative data. The two things that was brought up last night and was brought up this morning is that if a sanctuary is proposed and is accepted in this area, there will be staffing and there will be an office, not necessarily in Morro Bay. It could be in Santa Maria. It could be in Lompoc. We don't know that. And so on the economic activities that could be generated in Morro Bay, it's just not determined. The Channel Islands Sanctuary is a $2.5 million budget as of today, and the Monterey is a $2 million budget, which includes staffing and offices and support staff. To have a definite economic benefit of a sanctuary, I don't think that they can really determine that until a plan is made for this particular sanctuary, and as Alan said, it's to be determined. On the economic catch, fishing is being done right now, so for them to say that it will be increased, I don't think that could happen either. So I don't really have a lot of quantitative economic data. Lisa, I met with this morning. She has been kind enough to say I can ask her any questions or email her to get more quantitative data, and I talked to Ron about that earlier today, and I will, and I hope to report more on that.
Thank you. From my end of it, which has to do with local, regional, or state control, in terms of marine sanctuaries and their possible impact, and for the purpose of this report, I'll just call it local control, which includes local, regional, and state. Research to date, and not yet concluded by far, indicates that marine sanctuaries do, in fact, impact local control, both directly and indirectly. direct impacts result from the regulatory language that becomes part of a particular sanctuary's, quote, terms of designation, end quote, which is government speak for the rules and the regulations for that particular sanctuary, which are all different, by the way. If a given sanctuary's designation includes regulation regarding human use of the sanctuary or resource development and utilization within the sanctuary or local community access to the sanctuary for any number of purposes, then those federal, because everything that happens in a sanctuary is federal, those federal sanctuary regulations appear to take precedence over local control. Theoretically, whether a sanctuary's designation does or does not include regulation of a particular nature is a function of the development process for that sanctuary's terms of designation. That process, as was explained to us by NOAA yesterday evening, involves substantial opportunity for input from other government agencies, from communities, from business and industry interests, including agriculture and fishing, and other non-governmental organizations, NGOs. Based on study to date, it's unclear to me what of that input, be it negative or positive, ultimately becomes incorporated into the terms of a designation for a new marine sanctuary. All of this information comes in from involved or potentially impacted parties, goes into a big hopper, and it is not clear to me how much of it, under what circumstances, may become part of the designation. What does seem clear is that the ultimate decision and control regarding the nature and the content of a sanctuary's terms of designation lies strictly within the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency and its National Marine Sanctuary Program. It looks like that's where the decisions are made. Let's use an example. Water quality, for instance. In the case of the Central Coast, presently, ultimate control of water quality lies with the state and with its Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. According to my research to date, in the event of a marine sanctuary off the coast of Morro Bay, that regional water quality control continues up to the national marine sanctuary boundary closest to shore. In the case of the three established California marine sanctuaries north of Morro Bay, that shore boundary is designated as the mean high tide line. So the effective result is that a marine sanctuary with a shoreline, with such a shoreline boundary, can control the quality of water entering the sanctuary at the mean high tide line. As a note on this point, the NOAA folks who participated in last evening's forum state that it is incumbent upon a sanctuary to demonstrate or prove injury to sanctuary waters before being able to take regulatory action to prohibit water from shore entering the sanctuary waters. That's what they said. I have no other information about that. It would appear, therefore, that in the example of marine sanctuaries impacting local control over water quality, it's not a clear-cut situation, and they can do so by extension. So my last comment tonight regarding a marine sanctuary and local control relates to sanctuary advisory councils. Section 315 of the National Marine Sanctuaries Act authorizes the Secretary of Commerce to establish sanctuary advisory councils to provide advice to the Secretary of Commerce regarding the designation and the management of national marine sanctuaries. For instance, Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary has its own advisory council. Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary has its own advisory council. Sanctuary advisory councils are intended, this is the government talking, are intended to bring members of a diverse community together to provide advice to the sanctuary superintendent on the management of the sanctuary, or if there is a proposed sanctuary, in guiding a proposed site through the designation process. Well and good. The key question, however, is whether marine sanctuary administrators are obligated or mandated to incorporate advisory council input, whether it's positive or negative or neutral, into the decision-making and the policy-making of that sanctuary. It would seem not necessarily. A good analogy, I think, is our own body, the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board. We serve at the pleasure of the City Council, and the City Council is under no obligation or mandate to incorporate our input into their decision-making. That same reality appears to exist relative to marine sanctuary advisory councils, which can be populated with representation from local and regional government, local and regional business interests, local and regional environmental interests, and from other private and public parties. Ultimately, however, decisions regarding sanctuaries appear to be made wholly by the sanctuary agency. So, this ad hoc committee will continue to study the Federal Sanctuaries Act and what it might mean for a sanctuary to be established off the coast of Morro Bay. Additionally, we have a strong recommendation. We recommend that the public information process, public information process regarding marine sanctuaries continue. And I'm not talking about a particular application. I'm not talking about the Chumash application. I'm talking about in general. And that be done specifically through the organization of one or more additional public forums that feature representatives from California communities, harbors, ports, regional organizations, regional agencies, industry groups, and native groups who have experienced for some time living with an established sanctuary. The committee, and I think we all knew this when we raised our hands or whatever, but in November, this turns out to be a pretty big job because the body of information is vast and complicated. So I haven't discussed it with my other committee members, but I'd be astonished if they argued with me about it. We could use some help. And we're interested in not very many, one or two additional thoughtful people who have the time and the interest and are willing to work without bias, because this is not an advocacy activity, to help with this study. Thanks.
Thank you, Ron. Any questions? Gene?
Yeah, I was a little confused on the water quality issue. Would a marine sanctuary have control over the waters in Morro Bay?
No, but they could have if it's written into their designation.
Okay,
that's ultimate control. Ultimate control of any water that enters the sanctuary at whatever their shoreside boundary is, and if it's the mean high tide line, any stream, creek, outfall pipe, runoff,
harbor entrance.
Whatever
harbor
it might
entrance.
Be.
The harbor entrance?
The harbor, absolutely, yeah. The harbor entrance, right.
Neil?
So on that same train of thought, then, if you had, say, a cattle ranch up a creek 5 miles away and you were thought to maybe be adding some bacteria to the water that was going to the bay, would they have enough reach to start traveling up that far?
That's not my impression. My impression is that the sanctuary, if they either by virtue of their normal course of activity or because they became aware of a potential issue, they would test the sanctuary water closest to that inlet, and then they would determine, and I'm not sure what the criteria are, and nor could I get a quick answer to the question, what the injury might be, or if there is an injury at all, an injury to the sanctuary. And that's the word they use, is injury. But you can, you know, follow it upstream.
I think the terminology they use, Ron, is they try best management practices. They're supposedly not a regulatory agency per se. They want to and not enforce, but they want to try to get the ranchers, if they are in truth polluting into the bay, whatever that may be, they try to get them to clean it up voluntarily at this point in time. I believe the Monterey Sanctuary Superintendent is working with a lot of the farmers there in the Salinas Valley that have issues. So they do try to do best management practices in that respect. Lynn?
This is not on that subject. I don't know if anybody wishes to comment
on. Is there anyone more that needed to talk to Ron about the?
No, it's about marine. So my question is about marine sanctuaries, but not the water quality. Okay. I just thought there may be people who want to make another comment on that. You said that at the meeting last night, the representatives, the NOAA representatives, gave you to believe that they are very much in favor of wanting this marine sanctuary. Did they give you reasons why did they state the benefits that they thought would accrue to our community?
I did not hear specific benefits that would accrue to our community. And this is just personal commentary. As a member of the audience and listening as closely as I could, the NOAA folks that presented last night seemed extremely enthusiastic about the notion of marine sanctuaries. And as Dana just said, that's their job. Well, but one of the things that I think is important, and we didn't put it in our report, but one thing that's important to point out is that the Sanctuaries Act, as it exists right now, has sort of an conflicting, anomalous purpose in it. And this is, I'm paraphrasing, so it's not completely probably accurate. On one hand is protection and preservation of resources. And by that we mean ocean resources. On the other hand, the Act clearly says that multiple uses can take place in a sanctuary. And it doesn't necessarily define multiple uses. And over the years, this is going back to many, many, many years now, 40 years, multiple uses have been defined apparently over time as, for instance, resource utilization within a sanctuary, if it's part of the designation. So I didn't hear about that last night. What I heard about mostly, my impression was mostly about protection and preservation of ocean resources. So in addition to them being very enthusiastic, the staffers that were there last night, about marine sanctuaries, period, they were also, as I said, very enthusiastic and very focused. This is Director Duros talking about the desirability of linking the sanctuary that exists in the Channel Islands area with the three sanctuaries that exist farther north, and having one long sort of continuous sanctuary area. They're very focused on that.
Neil?
Well, he called you.
Sorry.
You said resource utilization. Is that the term you use?
That was my term.
Okay. But you said, on the other hand, they...
Preservation and protection.
Preservation and protection, and then resource utilization.
Sure.
So that could mean...
Could mean wind generation.
It could be oil development.
No, I think not. I think it's pretty clear that that's not going to happen, but in the sanctuaries, according to my reading, and I discussed this with the NOAA folks, and they acknowledge this, in the sanctuaries that are presently established, in those sanctuary areas where there were existing oil and gas leases, and the government did not buy them back as the sanctuary was established, those leases are grandfathered. But additional leases are prohibited.
Okay. The term grandfathered, and people that are in the planning understand all this, is that Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant would be probably grandfathered. The desalinization plant in Morro Bay, grandfathered. Those are existing usage.
Pardon me? I thought they lost that permit.
Well, supposedly. But my point being is that there is the uses that are currently existing, if a marine sanctuary does come into play, generally speaking, again, we don't know, a lot of the usage will be grandfathered in as part of the management plan.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Actually, they're required to... Existing leases, permits, they are required to honor unless they have a very compelling reason.
Gene?
And there are several oil leases offshore here.
Neil?
In reference to the comment, Ron, that you said they find it desirable to have one long sanctuary, in a recent letter of disapproval from a fellow oyster farmer here in Morro Bay. He did some research and tallied up all the miles of sanctuary in the United States. It's a national program. And of the over 24,000 miles of marine sanctuary in the United States, California has over 54% of those miles in marine sanctuary.
Already.
Excuse
me, are those square miles or linear?
That's a great question.
They must be square.
Yeah. Yeah.
The world.
Right. Then we answer that. Okay. Just a point of fact to the argument to say that we need one long sanctuary. Maybe I'm starting to become biased here in this comment, but it's just information.
No, it's good information. And as Ron stated, this is a very complex issue, and there's a lot of people that are involved in it that are for it and against it. So. That's what we're trying to do is get the facts and the information out to the people that hopefully will have a better opinion of whether it's right for us. Lynn or Alan?
Yeah, I had one more comment about that. I prepared a card for last night's meeting, and it actually got read, but unfortunately the cards were long, and frequently you could tell that not all the information that was in the preamble to the question got out, and that happened to my question. And this is about the idea of how much territory a sanctuary should take. And the Act deals with this on the first page. they talk about specific areas. And in the beginning of the Act, they use the word specific areas several times. And I'm a little troubled that we're taking all the area from way outside, all the way to the beach, all the way up and down the coast. And I don't understand how that can be a specific area of vital interest to have these special regulations and bureaucracy to protect it. It seems like we're getting close to saying, well, the coast of the United States is a sanctuary from one end to the other, at least the West Coast, although in Oregon they've thrown down the gauntlet and it's not going in Alaska too. But here in California, it looks like it's on the way to becoming one big sanctuary. I asked him my question. I said, wouldn't it be a good idea to leave a place as a control to see what it's like if you don't have a sanctuary to compare the sanctuary's performance? That didn't get read. Anyway, that's my thought.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Ron
for Marine Sanctuary?
The one thing that was brought up here with our ad hoc committees, which is directed to the City Council liaison, Matt, is there a possibility that you could meet with the chairs so that some of our recommendations, i.e. the boat haul out facility, it's a little bit unnerving to me that, that you guys aren't even going to consider it until the summer. I mean, this is something that I wasn't aware of right now. Is there any possibility that you can meet with the ad hoc chairs or at least communicate with them? So we have four ad hoc committees. We have four chairs. Yeah, come on.
Totally. I would feel more than comfortable in terms of I'm kind of making a list right now. What I'd like to do when I go back to the City Council meetings is read my list as the advisory liaison to council. But then, obviously, if you any of you feel stronger about a certain issue, please email me, give me a note, and I will definitely read that. I do believe that's part and parcel of the advisory purpose.
Ron?
Matt, what would be, I think, very useful to any ad hoc committee is if there was some way, without the committee necessarily having to take the initiative, to know what the status is of, for instance, a board recommendation that came out of a committee's action. And let's take Dana's example. You know, so the board made a recommendation to the City Council, and what would be wonderful is if there was some mechanism that made it very easy with us necessarily having to impact your time to determine what the status of board actions were.
I think to be pragmatic yet diplomatic about that, Ron, I think it would be just a case, a working relationship as these recommendations come up from your board to City Council. And then like Eric says, and necessarily as the mayor and those agenda items are kind of put through the year, not necessarily giving excuses. I'm just trying to think of how this could work also. I think a continuing dialogue with that, say, for instance, because of the recommendation, talking about the proposed boatyard. I mean, this is a big issue, not just for the Harbor Advisory Board, but I would argue for the entire town. And so you've made that. It's come to staff. But I think just an update, you can see, you know, if you see me or vice versa through that chain of command. And, you know, because I don't know how diligent we could all be to give immediate responses to some of those, you know, just to be fair, because I would not want to say, yeah, I'll do it every month, because that might not necessarily be on the agenda. So I think that would be setting us up, ourselves up for failure too. So would it be fair to say, and I would be acceptable for this, is try to do my best as the liaison to council to come back with requests, and vice versa from any of you to say, hey, Matt, what's the status of this? Would that be fair?
Okay. Eric, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I just want to add, I think it, and I'll point the finger at me to a degree, that it is somewhat incumbent on me to keep you guys apprised of actions you've taken, recommendations you've made. I do my best to put things in the status report. Certainly, we maybe need to establish a better means or a different means of communicating with the committee chairs to me, because I'm constantly working with the city manager and staff and, you know, little permutations of things going on. About the boatyard and the summer six-month comment that Alan made, I'll touch a bit on that. The boatyard, the city acquired the Triangle lot, parking was one of the major hopes that the city had for that lot. Then the idea of this Embarcadero Promenade came along that's going to eat up parking spaces. So the city's got to do something to recreate those. So the Triangle lot became, hey, there's a spot where all of a sudden we got parking spaces. Well, now the boatyard wants to live in there too, and the Maritime Museum. So the study, we've got RRM doing a study for the promenade. The reason the boatyard, that comment that I made to Alan earlier today, the council, and I'm looking at my crystal ball a little bit here, but I've made the assumption, and through working with my boss, the city council shouldn't be or isn't going to want to make a decision necessarily on the boatyard until we know what we may be doing with this promenade, because if that process goes forward too, it's going to want parking somewhere, and if the boatyard takes away all the parking, so we've got to balance the two, so it makes sense to start tying those two together in terms of at least the parking to see what it may be. The city's looking at other parking options to help make up, you know, in that RRM study, whatever the promenade may take in parking. So the Triangle lot's going to be looked to for making up some degree of the parking lost in that promenade study. So getting the boatyard out ahead of that project it's going to get out of whack to where the promenade may come back and change something. So we don't want to get one out in front of the other. So that's where that comment came from, if I'm not talking in circles too much here.
But also, I'm sorry if I could also add to that.
Absolutely.
My view, coming from the former advisory council person, is I do believe it was incumbent upon the advisory boards to push the agenda that you think is most valuable. And so with that working boatyard, with that triangle parking lot, with the Measure D, if that's big business, I mean, I would think it's incumbent upon you, if that's what you feel, to make sure that you tell staff and city council, say, look, this takes precedence over a promenade plan. That's my case or my point of view.
In aid of that, Eric, is it reasonable to have the staff report include on a routine basis the status of any outstanding board recommendation to the city council?
Yeah, that would make sense to just put that into the status report. I mean, I've got recent city council actions, so those are actions the council has taken, and many of them have been board promulgated.
Thank you, Matt.
from the Harbor Advisory Board. Absolutely, we could add a section into there to things that council hasn't decided on. They're still in the works. I can certainly add that into the status report, kind of an update on those in-progress items. Absolutely.
But I think Matt made an interesting point, too, is that we as Harbor Advisory Board here, we had a strategic meeting, and I believe the number one project and goal that we saw forth was the boat haul-out facility. And I personally would like to push it forward even before the promenade, and one of the council members, when I was at the city council meeting, said, you know, parking or boatyard. I still don't buy that, personally. So, you know, I still think that we need to push and we need to email our city council to make this a top priority, period. Okay. Let's get down to the status update. C5, which is the State Park Marina, and discussion input on possible dredge material disposable options. Eric?
Thank you. So this is from our future agenda list, as well as I think some ongoing things. This is mostly going to be an update, but I'm looking at the end of the staff report for some, not necessarily direction, but some concurrence from the Harbor Advisory Board and some conclusions I've drawn. So I'll try to go quickly through here. As you know, back in April last year, we took public input at a Harbor Advisory Board meeting for the future of the State Park Marina and the cafe. That's the one where State Parks was in attendance, and they were looking at the question was, okay, we're going to put these out to RFP for request for proposals. What does the public want to see for services, amenities, and so forth in these two facilities? That meeting turned largely into a support for Bayside Cafe, staying the sort of incumbent concessionaire at the cafe through the state park. And that sentiment carried through the Harbor Advisory Board through a recommendation to the City Council that the city encourage the pursuing with the state that state parks allow the city to manage the cafe RFP process and subsequent cafe concession management. The recommendation was taken to the City Council in closed session on July 13th. Obviously, closed session I can't reveal a heck of a lot about because it's closed session, confidential. But the result of that was that the mayor wrote a letter to State Parks proposing that the city be allowed to take over the cafe RFP process and subsequent management of the concession. On November 24th, that letter went out on July 13th this year, or last year. On November 24th, 2015, we received a letter from State Parks Director Lisa Manget. Parks essentially rejected the city's proposal, saying, no, we think it should stay separate. Both the letters from the mayor to the state parks and from state parks back are included with your staff report. Parks basically said, no, we think cafe should be separate. Cafe revenues shouldn't be used to support the marina and vice versa. And our study shows that, financial study shows that over 30 years, the revenues from the state park marina should support dredging and renovation. We took the item back to closed session, city council, on December 4th, and the result of that will be that the city is writing a subsequent letter back to the state parks reiterating its position, and we're going to re-engage state parks about this whole issue. From a discussion standpoint, on the marina alone, really until we find a viable and financially viable means of disposing of the approximately 60,000 cubic yards of material left in that marina, find a viable place to put it and dispose of it that isn't cost prohibitive. It's really not going to make a sense, in staff's opinion, it's really not going to make sense for the city to continue to pursue that State Park Marina operating agreement and dredging project just because money's not falling from the sky. The state's not coming up with any money for it. We pretty much tapped out all the grant funding we could from the Department of Boating and Waterways. And it's our opinion that even with if we were to get the cafe concession and subsequent revenues from that, unless we can find a viable, financially viable means of disposing of the dredge materials, it's not going to pay for itself over 30 years. The State Parks' study that they did, the financial analysis they did, was assuming that the dredge materials could be disposed of in the near shore as we do normal dredging disposal, which we did for the first third of the material there, 30,000 yards. It assumed those costs. Unless we can get the regulatory agencies, and I'll talk about this a little later, to bend the rules, we're not going to be allowed to dispose of the material there, and it's going to have to go upland or some other creative means, which means more money. And it comes to a point where the cost-benefit doesn't pencil out anymore. So we really believe, staff really believe, that we've got to crack this dredging nut before we go forward with it anyway, in any means. New developments have occurred fairly recently. One of those is the city embarking on the project to move its wastewater treatment plant. Previously, even when the city was proposing to put it down where it is now, there was looking like they're going to have a definite need for fill material. Even though the State Park Marina material is largely silt and mud, it can be amended with various agents. We've spoken to a couple consultants about this. It is usable as fill material. Now the wastewater treatment plant's moving up Highway 41 a mile or three. It's very probable that they're going to need fill material on that site, and it's very probable that we're going to need fill material back at the old wastewater treatment plant site when that site gets repurposed for whatever the city ends up envisioning that place to be. And also, the closing of the Dynegy power plant, currently they're trying to sell it. Nothing really that we're aware of that's actively happening there in terms of proposals. But if that site does get sold and some sort of a developer comes in, there's a real possibility that they may need fill material or may be able to take fill material for something that could potentially happen there. This is obviously fairly speculative, but it's still something that's come up on the radar screen. As far as the wastewater treatment plant moving, I think the target for closing one valve and opening the other to make the stuff flow from one to the other is about 5 years out, which is not, it sounds like a long time, but it really isn't when it comes to permitting and planning and executing these types of projects. So the timing still seems to be good. And then there's other possibilities in terms of dredge material disposal, one of them being there's a term for it I've got in here. I'll have to go back and look for it. Confined aquatic disposal, meaning this is a regulatory means of disposing of dredge materials that's accepted by the regulatory agencies, where basically we'd go find another part of the bay that we can get, dig a large hole, put our sand and mud inside of that large hole, cover the hole back up with sand, and then use the clean material and either dispose of it somewhere else, the sand somewhere else, or use it to potentially raise a portion of the bay from a deeper depth to a shallower depth to maybe create some eelgrass or other habitat that might be usable. So those are a couple of the potential disposal options. A third notion that's come forward from a couple of quarters recently is the notion of basically sacrificing part of the state park marina itself to maintain the rest, meaning we take the eastern, and I'm just throwing some guess numbers out there, but let's say it's if you could close the eastern third of the marina, build a retaining wall in there or a sheet pile wall in there, dredge the rest of the remaining marina, and fill the portion that you're closing, which was once water, and now fill that with dredge material, compact it, where would the numbers trade off in terms of is it you have to sacrifice a third of it, a half of it? Is that a notion that's something that could be acceptable to the public and to the user? So we're throwing out that out there as a possibility to at least keep part of the marina open. It seems like it may be viable. You could potentially dig the remaining portion maybe a little wider or a little deeper and build some slips out off the shore instead of the ones that just face the shore now, which really limits the number. So we're throwing the notion of that out there. So those are the kind of things that are sort of at play here. So in conclusion, again, we're primarily, this is sort of an update of where we are on the Bayside Cafe part of it and the city's efforts and the Harbor Advisory Board's recommendation to see if the state wants to give that up. So it's an update on that. But it's also getting some Harbor Advisory Board input and see if there's concurrence or advisability on these three potential options that we're looking at. Option one, engaging a consultant to pursue regulatory approval for cost-effective ocean and other aquatic disposal, and that's can we get, I guess what I'd call a variance, to dispose of our dredge material in the nearshore disposal area. As you know, but I'll reiterate, the material that we have there is sand and silt, which under current regulation isn't compatible with the beach because when we put it in the nearshore, it's for beach replenishment. Can we get a variance for that? Confined aquatic disposal, is that a potential option? We believe it's important to engage a consultant to see if those options are possible before we move forward with really going any further with trying to manage this marina. So we believe we should undertake that task. Number two, researching the use of the dredge material as upland fill, wastewater treatment plant, the old wastewater treatment plant site, the new water reclamation site, potentially on the Dynegy property, or other sites. When we pursued this 10-odd years ago when we first got into the operating agreement, former Harbor Director Rick Allgaert and others, and I think we had, through our environmental document, we had identified several other sites. One of them was up in San Simeon, Cambria area. I think even the old landfill on Turry Road that used to be a county landfill was looked at. All of those were set aside. There was really nothing within a close enough range that once you put the trucking cost to move the material those distances, it just didn't pencil out anymore from a financial standpoint. But with these new developments with the treatment plants, maybe needing fill material in the Dynegy plant, we believe it's these alternatives should be researched to see if indeed As we get closer, it looks like we're pretty darn close to the original plant, that the place that the water reclamation facility was going to go. Rancho Colima, I believe, has fallen through. We're now moving to a site, I think it's closer to the city, Morro Bay city limits, less further out. And this is looking like we're getting, homing in on that. Public Works is homing in on that and getting all the paperwork and agreements and property acquisitions in place. And once that occurs, which is happening relatively rapidly, probably going to be within this year when we keep moving forward on real engineering and next steps on that site, then we'll be able to identify what sort of fill material they may need. So I think we should pursue that and thoroughly research that, because that may provide us an outlet for our material. And then researching the option of closing part of the marina to save the rest. You know, cut off an arm to save the body. So we want to see if these three actions, you know, if we get the concurrence of the Harbor Advisory Board, these three items here, and see what sort of input we may receive. So with that, I'll quit talking and turn it back to the board.
I have a couple questions first, though. One, how much money do we have budgeted for the Back Bay Marina? I think there is some money still in the line item. Is that correct? I think it's like $40,000.
The funds we have for that, and we do need to open up for public comment at some point, but the funds we have for that are strictly come from our operating agreement. When we did the dredging 2.5-3 years ago, we basically spent that down to almost zero. We've probably got another, and I'm somewhat guessing, but $115,000, $120,000 in there, I believe. We get about $60,000, $65,000, $70,000 a year from the operating agreement.
Okay, so I need to open up this public comment. Is there anyone that has any public comment here? Matt? Okay. So public comment is closed. Okay, so we have about $125,000 for various studies and various other types of activities for that Back Bay Marina right now.
Correct.
Okay. Alan?
How much cheaper is it to do ocean dredge disposal? I mean, as soon as it goes on a truck, what happens? How much does the cost go up? I mean, the seat of the pants.
Number-wise, to move the 30,000 cubic yards we did, it took about $1.5 million. It's the estimate. The previous estimates we had for moving it pretty far north were in the, I want to say $7 or $8 million.
$7 to $8 million.
It was a lot more. Every time you handle it, it just increases the cost.
No, this is in the report. It was $7 to $8 million.
What does it take to go? How far with that?
Well, I'm saying it's somewhere around 600 truckloads.
600 truckloads?
Yeah, not including repairing the roads.
And you said $1.5 million for the barge?
Yeah.
Right, the barge to go out.
Because the problem with inland, you've got to get it out of the water, put it on land somewhere, take most of the water off of it, decant it off, and then get it in a truck and move it somewhere. So every time you handle it and move it, you just keep adding costs, where when you scow it out, you're just throwing it wet in the scow and it goes out.
So these ideas for taking it to local sites, it's still going to cost considerably more.
It's still going to be more. I think what made our estimates from the previous decade or so ago when we first looked at this was that the only viable site we had was sand, cement, cable.
It was Wilmar disposable site is what it's called.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, Terry Road would be so much closer, but, you know, still expensive, I suppose, in some regard.
Yeah.
Neil, you have a question?
Question, comment. So before this, I spoke with a civil engineer who referred me to a couple local construction companies, and they're more in large construction, earthworks and grading, and I'm waiting for responses back to see if they, you know, as it was explained to me, that they have fill yards that they can take soil that might not be ready or sediment that might not be ready, and if it's got biologicals in there that need to decompose, they can let it sit, and there might be a few yards in San Luis Obispo, San Luis Obispo proper, and then possibly in the county. That's why I was interested in what those, you said 600 truckloads, because I wrote 60,000 cubic yards is what's still left to move. But anyway, I was just, yeah, okay. So I don't know if, that pursuit is worth it if there's other options here, but if those places wouldn't I mean, are the other options that you have on land, they're all going to charge to dispose of? If a place like this might be a win-win if they didn't charge, and I don't know if it's...
Yeah, every site's going to be different. I think the previous efforts we looked at filling the old quarry site that's back just east of the State Park Marina across Southlake Boulevard. There's an old, a lot of that area was quarried up on that quarry trail. It wasn't enough volume. We looked at the power plant, borrow pit, potential there. There wasn't enough size there to take it all, even which is the big hole right outside, be on the other side of the fence over here. Just see to the pants, I look at that and I say, boy, 60,000 cubic yards would disappear in there pretty quick, but apparently it wasn't large enough. And power plant, owners at the time weren't interested, and I think it's a huge Native American site over there, and I think Native Americans weren't interested in it. Again, I think we looked at, like I said, the Turi Road, when it used to be a county disposal site, but it's no longer a county disposal site, so that went off the table. We were trying to, obviously, you take it out of the water and put it upland, and you're going to have to do the decanting and dry it out and move it. The truck trips, you know, just pure distance and driving time is what added just a ton of cost to it. At some point, you cross that boundary of this just isn't financially feasible anymore, so I think we need to look locally to see if we need fill, you know, let's say we need 30,000 cubic yards at the new water reclamation facility. Where does the city go and get 30,000 cubic yards? Do you have to go pay for it? Do you just ask every contractor in the county, hey, when you got extra dirt, bring it over here, and you start dumping it in piles? I imagine the city's going to have to pay for fill over there at some point. So there may be a win-win where the city doesn't have to go, hey, pay for us to get this dredge material out of here. You can have all you want. Those are the kind of things we think is worth looking into. So.
Ron? Two questions. One, did I understand you to say in your staff report that the city is going to re-engage State Parks and Recreation relative to the letter that Director Mangat sent?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And if you're in a position to tell us, is the city simply going to repeat the request in Mayor Irons' letter, or is the city taking a different tack?
We've got a few more cards up our sleeve.
Okay. 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 And my second question is that given that the situation seems so clear relative to determining the practical and economic feasibility of disposing of dredge spoils from the State Park site, does this board need to make any recommendation to the City Council? It seems pretty compelling.
Yes, I'm thinking while I'm answering that, again, looking for State Park or for Harbor Advisory Board recommendation or concurrence on the three points that I make in the conclusion, yes. And if, again, I think if for the city to continue pursuing this, we've got to solve the dredging problem. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just pointless. CAFE, otherwise, it doesn't make sense to stay in the operating agreement. So we've got, I believe there's the next couple of steps here to engage this. Would a Harbor Advisory Board recommendation to the City Council along the lines of these three steps help? Yeah, I mean, it's that's what your part of your mandate is.
All right, so I move to recommend to the City Council that the city engage consultancy relative to obtaining regulatory approval for cost-effective ocean or aquatic disposal of said dredge spoils, and or determine the practical and economic feasibility of utilizing dredge spoils as a landfill.
I'll second that.
I have a first with Ron making a motion. Gene seconded it. Any discussion? Gene?
Eric, have we put out any requests for proposals to anybody about what this consultant would cost? Do you have any idea what consultant would charge?
I'm getting an estimate from one right now, Anchor QEA, who's our consultant we use for the marina dredging in the first place. I've probably said this before, but I'll restate it. They're mostly ex-Corps of Engineers employees. They were involved in the Newport Beach eelgrass mitigation proposal. They've done a lot of confined aquatic disposal projects, so they're well-versed in this world, and we know them and have worked with them, so I'm getting a proposal from them right now. Any other comments, questions?
I have one.
Alan?
Ever since I came to Morro Bay back in the late 70s, I've always thought that the marina in the Back Bay was probably one of the most beautiful marinas in California. Seems like a real shame to let it go down.
I agree. Dana?
Oh, Lynn?
No, go ahead. Dana?
I was just going to agree with Alan, and also the motion discussing these first two options that you came up with, what staff came up with, I really don't want to see the third one happen. If that would be like the last resort, would be to reduce the size. So I would be in favor of this motion.
Lynn?
Yeah, this is backing up a little bit perhaps, but as far as disposing of the spoils in the near shore, the only objection to that is because of the silt, and the intent is for beach replenishment. Is that true?
Correct. Go ahead.
If my memory serves me right, I think there was talk at some time that somehow these spoils with the fines in them are detrimental to the fish, to the wildlife in the ocean where they dump them.
So, I'm going to probably answer a lot more than you just asked. The regulatory framework requires that for the nearshore disposal, and the disposal sites we have, the approved EPA-approved sites we have, the one just south of the harbor entrance and then on the beach, as you know, when we pipeline it down there
right. And
go north of the beach, those are for beach replenishment / beach nourishment. In other words, keeping sand on the beach because for various reasons, a lot of which are man-made, we've created situations that make sand come off our beaches and don't come back. So anything generally that can be done to replenish sand on beaches is generally smiled upon by the regulatory agencies, including this. In order to put material in those sites, it has to be compatible with the beach, meaning 80% of the material disposing of has to be compatible, 20% can be non-compatible, meaning the same grain size. Sand, silt, mud obviously have different grain sizes. Silt and mud don't match the 80-20, so we got, for the material we did dispose of, the 30,000 yards we did, it was about a 50-50 mix. It cost us a lot of extra money in monitoring to do that. It was only allowed because the Corps of Engineers was coming in right afterwards and putting about 300,000 cubic yards on top of it. We had to kind of, I want to say, shuck and jive a little bit with the regulators to get them to allow us to do that, and it was a very small amount. And turns out it didn't have any adverse effects. Silt and mud comes down our watersheds all the time and ends up out in the ocean. It belongs out there. It goes out there. In larger quantities, what you would have to do to show that it's not going to have any adverse effects, I think it's accepted that those materials don't end up on the beach. Just by natural forces, they end up in deeper water. That's why when you pull crab traps out in 300 feet and beyond, it's all mud stuck to the bottom of them. That's where the mud goes. That's a given. The material, fine silt and mud in the near shore, can be potentially detrimental to the creatures that live in the sand because it's not sand. And I think that's one of the issues and one of the things that we had to do to test their materials and that failed, that it didn't allow us to dispose of more material in the near shore. It was called a bioassay, meaning they have a representative suite of critters that live in the sand, and they take your representative sand and mud, silt and mud, and see if those creatures will live in there. Well, they don't, because that's not normally where they live. So it can potentially have a detrimental effect. It's not because it's chemically polluted or because it's contaminated in any way. It's just a material that those critters aren't used to living in, and it's not good for them. So It's a fairly large regulatory hurdle to get over, but it's one we believe we should at least explore the possibility of seeing where the regulatory agencies may be on it, because it's a really, you know, 60,000 cubic yards isn't a lot. The Corps, like I say, they do 250,000, 300,000 every summer when they're here. It's a small amount, so we believe it's worth investigating. So,
did they not do a study on dumping a greater proportion of fines in Santa Cruz a number of years ago?
It's ongoing in Santa Cruz, and they did a similar study down in Imperial Beach, down in San Diego, and put
and
a lot of fines
no
in.
And there were no deleterious effects, as I remember.
Well,
the studies concluded.
Under certain operational parameters in which the quantities and volumes and everything else, it's not just an open gate and let it go. It's a bit of a challenge for them. But yes, it's a precedent that we look to and will be looking to as an example to help sway the regulators. Yeah. But still, the 80-20 rule is the 80-20 rule, and it's until
be
we
it logical or illogical.
It's hard to get out from under it.
Yeah, Dana.
Yeah, if I recollect, also there was talk that next year, 2017, there may be a bigger dredge going down the bay as far as dredging. We have our annual, or hopefully our annual harbor entrance, but there was talk of going down the bay farther with a bigger dredge activity. Is there a possibility of using that, pulling this material out for that dredge to pick up in a way?
So we're hoping to get funded. We're hoping to get funded for our whole harbor dredging in the upcoming 17 federal fiscal year, which begins in October. 2010 was the last time we do it, so we're going on 6-7 years out now since we got our whole harbor dredged, and that's the Corps of Engineers, and they're responsible, and they fund it. It takes it getting into the president's budget, and the reason I go back to Washington, D.C. every year is to try and ensure that funding. If we get funded this year, which is a possibility, we've been recommending it. Knock on wood, we may be getting closer. It sounds like we're at least maybe in the work plan, the Corps' work plan, whether we get off the Corps' work plan and in the president's budget. That's the big question we got to get through OMB, the Office of Management of the Budget in Washington, D.C., and that's the hard part. But if we do get funded, yeah, the Corps will be coming through and going all the way back to the Inetmore Bay and doing the whole channel. Could it be possible for the city to piggyback on that? Maybe. We did, as you may recall, back in 2002, 2003, when we dredged our mooring area. We did that in conjunction with the Corps project because one of the biggest costs of those large dredging contractors coming in are mobilization and demobilization, just getting here and leaving. Huge cost. And with the Corps coming in and paying for that, we piggybacked onto it. So basically the Corps pays for mob and demob, and we get the advantage of not having to pay for that, and it was a fairly low cost to do that. Could we potentially do that for the Tate Park Marina? That would make some sense if we can get the regulatory approval still for that 60,000 cubes to go out into the ocean, because that's where it's going to go, or on the beach. And that will be one of the questions for the consultant to consider with their expertise. And, you know, let's say it's, you know, 800,000 cubic yards and the city's adding 60,000 cubic yards of silt. In total, you're under the 80-20 potentially. Definitely something worth looking at, which we will be.
So we have a motion on the table, and we have a second. Do I hear any other discussion? Neil?
This might be premature. I would just say that the other thing that we haven't talked about was dropping the spoils back inside of Morro Bay and creating eelgrass habitat. I'd remind everybody that in the eelgrass presentation, the most successful place for eelgrass was the Army Corps of Engineers' creation of eelgrass habitat. And that's still thriving with survivability. I'll then put on my other hat as an oyster farmer and know that when they did that dredging, a lot of fecal coliform bacteria spiked up and shut my farm down for about a month. So I've kind of, it's a double-edged sword for me personally, but objectively, if you're looking for eelgrass, it's great. Oyster farmers, we have a bit of a risk. Luckily, this last time when they did the 30,000 cubic feet, we raised a little bit of a stink before, and everybody was gracious and listened and put silk curtains, and we had zero effect. So it was contained. And as far as the toxicity, there wasn't a toxic issue with the fish. It's just we get tested regularly on bacteria in the water, and there can be dormant fecal bacteria. And there was a lift station repair and an old pipeline that was repaired, I think, about 8 years ago. That's all should be serviced fine now. But before, when that was the first project was going on, we were nervous because there was a potential for some kind of accumulation in the soil. So I think if practices were used like that and the site maybe wasn't put right next to the oyster farm, we'd, as an oyster farm hat, we'd probably support that. So just something to contemplate.
Thanks. A quick note about silt and mud. In the Bay Area, there's several projects underway to create wetlands habitat that are being utilizing dredge material from the Bay Area. Right now, they've got several disposal sites outside the gate that most of the materials go to. There's actually some inside the San Francisco Bay as well. But there's several places where, and a lot of the waterfowl groups participate in the funding for this because it creates waterfowl hunting habitat. There's several areas where they're restoring or creating wetlands out of dredge material. Not complete yet, but one of the theories, recent theories going around the eelgrass world, for the decline of our eelgrass, and what some of the folks are looking at, I know the NEP is looking at it through a Sea Grant program in Cal Poly, there's the possibility that the fine silts and muds are not good eelgrass habitat, and because we've got so much of it out here, that may be not a good thing for eelgrass. So that's where that aquatic disposal may work better, where you dig a big hole in the sand and put that aside underwater, then you put your silt and mud and cover it back up, and then you take the sand and create some habitat out of it. It'd be better for creating eelgrass habitat. Can the silt and mud be used for other wetland habitat? Yeah, possibly. And is it suitable inside the harbor? Yeah, who knows? Maybe something to be looked at. That's the aquatic disposal option that we may be looking at.
There is a 50-foot hole in the bay where it's 50 feet deep, right off the end of Morro Bay, and they're not using that area. Yeah, it's an eddy. It'll be gone.
Okay, then. So hearing no other discussion, we have a motion on the table. All in favor, say aye. Aye. All opposed? So you have your recommendation, Eric.
Thank you for that, and we will work with Matt, and we'll get that to City Council. Okay. Can I indulge you to look at item number 3 there? And I hear last resort, which I agree with. Like I termed it earlier, it's kind of like cutting off your arm to save the body. Something's gangrenous. You got to cut it off to save the body. Is that, in the Harbor Advisory Board's opinion, is obviously last resort, or is that just no way, no how? Any discussion on that?
Alan?
I assume that would be by far the cheapest option, right? Because you're not even taking the barge anywhere. You're just moving it.
It would probably be very cost effective because you may not even need to barge it.
Okay. I don't have an opinion.
Well, I mean, I think that if you're going to do a study, you should probably do a study on all the options, my personal opinion. Gene?
Well, so you cut off the arm. So then in 10 years from now, you cut off the other arm. About right?
So in other words,
I'm 70 years from now is what I'm hoping.
So I think you're right. I don't think that we as a body here want to even look at that option right now. Lynn?
Well, if that's the only thing we could do to save the marina at this point in time, I would say yes, we would consider it. If it's losing the marina completely or having a smaller marina, which presuming it would still be financially viable, I would say I would certainly accept that, but obviously that's not the first choice, or the second, or the third. It's the last choice.
Neil?
And I'm sure there's going to be some boat owners back there that will be happy because they can get to their boats, and the other ones will be unhappy because they no longer have a boat there. But if there was an ability within that plan to possibly restructure the, what you're already digging up, maybe restructure that marina and create new slips, and there's a net loss of zero, but it looked, you know, from a triangle to a square, maybe wouldn't be the end of the world.
Ron, you had a question?
Yeah.
Comment?
As it relates to restructuring it, you mentioned, I think in your staff presentation, the possibility of restructuring the marina and maybe adding some slips or something very close to that. Has there been any careful study, any feasibility study of how many slips could be relocated and what the size and the water depth might be, what would be the net impact on the existing marina structure, a marina layout?
If you were to close off part of it to, no, it's, when we did the initial project back 10 or so years ago, it did look at, obviously the whole renovation and dredging had a new layout, it had a net increase of slips to, I would say maybe 10 or 15 slips. As Neil mentioned, you know, take a triangle and turn it into a square. You know, as you get further west down the marina, you kind of triangle out, and that's why all the slips just face the shore right there. What I would envision, if that were an option that we were to pursue, you dig out further beyond the boats that are just up to shore there to make slips, fingers extending out there instead of the shoreward, and that would be how you would make up some of the difference. But no, nobody's put anything to paper at this point. It's all just
and to state the obvious, that requires infrastructure cost.
Yeah.
Somebody would have to pay for it.
Yeah, well, if let's say we could dispose of the material on the near shore right now and go dredge those 60,000 cubic yards, the plan is to pull out that whole marina anyhow and rebuild it. So that infrastructure cost is going to be there if that project were to move forward in its current configuration. If you reconfigured it in this new way and closed off part of it, you're still going to tear out all the slips and reconfigure. So you're still going to have the infrastructure cost.
Is that the city's hypothetical planning? I don't mean that in a negative way. Or is that the state? Is the state involved in that?
This is all comes back to the operating agreement. The operating agreement's premise was State of California gives the city of Morro Bay the right to manage the marina concessionaire, collect the revenues that the state was collecting, and pursue a whole marina dredging and renovation project as basically envisioned or stipulated, and we engaged consultants, and we basically took on a project of X and Y scope and said, this is what the renovation project is. And that renovation project was rebuilding, revetment, putting some sheet pile in to stabilize the southern side of the marina, basically tearing out all the slips and replacing them, some reconfiguration to put some bigger slips in, dredging the marina the whole nine yards. So the operating agreement said, if the city does XYZ renovation and dredging, then they can either concessionaire it out at the end of the project or operate the marina themselves. And that's when we started getting, you know, starting getting the financial feasibility of it, and then we discovered the dredge material couldn't go in the ocean, so then we looked at the other options, and then the cost went to $20 million, and we had maybe five or six in grants that we pursued, not even five or six, I'm going to say maybe two and a half or three. A lot of it got eaten up in engineering and planning and permitting, and then we had, like I said, about $1.5 million left to move mud, which we did, and that burned down all those grants to pretty much zero, exhausted all our funding, and then pretty much, you know, work came to a halt at that point because we had no more funding and couldn't dispose of the materials in the near shore. So that's where we are today. So that's where the where my comment of we were going to tear it all out anyhow in the original operating agreement. That was what we had to do under the operating agreement. That's what the city agreed to, and that's what State Parks wanted, and that's what the project envisioned.
If you know, does the city have an opinion as to the accuracy and usefulness as a predictor of the Pacific Group report dated May 30th, 2014? Because we're talking about future revenue now. I mean, in a general sense, you're talking about future revenue.
That Pacific Group report assumed a fairly significant increase in revenues on slip fees. It assumed some new revenue sources through the kayak shack and possible other visitor-serving concessionaire-type uses. So it assumed an increased revenue stream. It also assumed the dredging costs of nearshore disposal based on the dollar figures that were originally derived when we did this project a decade ago, because that's the only data that I had to give the Pacific Group in terms of what the operating agreement stipulated and the costs analysis that we had done. That's what they based their figures on.
But it's my understanding that they used those numbers without an inflator.
I couldn't say one way or another on that. I don't know if they used
Well, that's anecdotal on my part. Thinking about the prior costs, the hard cost data, and reading the report about the projected costs of dredging. So I guess my only point is that I'm hopeful that the city, as it plans for its options and its acquisition of the of an operating agreement relative to the site, which would be great, that it not hang its hat solely on the financial figures that are offered in the Pacific Group's May 30th, 2014 report.
No, and I wouldn't recommend that either moving forward. I would, if we can get a little more work done and figure out a solution to the dredging puzzle and figure out a what appears to be a cost-effective solution, I think we go back in with our own financial analysis, revenue and expense, and see where it pencils out in real dollars. Because you're correct that whether Pacific Group took the numbers I gave them that we had from our early 2000s estimate and adjusted those to current dollars, I don't know. I just know they assumed the original estimates that were done for the renovation and dredging back in the early 2000s.
Well, the sequence that you just laid out is perfectly sensible. Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay. So we go to C6.
Still got a motion on the table.
Oh.
You haven't voted yet.
No, we voted.
Did you vote?
Yeah.
You just asked us if we would.
All right.
Give you more.
Okay, you're right. I'm asleep.
So we go to, listen, Eric, we go C6, the election of the Harbor Advisory Board chair and vice chair. So the staff recommendation is to elect a chair and a vice chair. Do I hear any nominations?
I make a nomination that we re-nominate Bill for chair.
I will accept that. Do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. I have a first and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? So on the vice chair, do I have a motion to elect a vice chair?
I move Dana McClish.
Ron?
I decline.
So is that
a... He declined.
You mean that?
Yes.
Okay. So we need a vice chair. Does anyone have a recommendation for a vice chair? Lynn?
I nominate Ron.
Okay. We have You're, we have a first by Lynn for Ron and a second by Dana. Any discussion?
I feel good about it.
All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? No. Okay, thank you. I'll try to do a little better job this year. I appreciate your declaration of future agenda items. The one thing that Eric brought to my attention that I think that we need to discuss for a future agenda item is the State Park Fish and Game hunting. What was it, Eric?
Back Bay hunting regulations.
Yeah, Back Bay hunting regulations. Apparently, could you explain what's coming up quickly that I think that we need to...
Yeah, so the city council is interested in considering the weighing in on the Back Bay hunting regulations. I had it scheduled through the city manager on a certain track. We just learned back in December that Fish and Game has drastically changed their schedule. It was going to start up in the late spring and then go through summer, and then they adopt in fall was the old timing of it. They've now changed their timing because the state waterfowl hunting regulations follow federal, and the federal track suddenly moved up in time because apparently they hadn't been doing it when they're supposed to be doing it. So now Fish and Game's changed drastically. They had a first hearing in December 10th of basically a notice of intent to amend the waterfowl regulations back in December, there were some proposals brought forward to Fish and Game that had some discussion unrelated to Morro Bay and the Black Brant hunting and waterfowl hunting, although there was some comments to the Morro Bay and some requests to change the Morro Bay regulations. Fish and Game staff turned that down, and I don't think the commission entertained any changes to the Morro Bay regulations. However, they interchanged some possible changes to what staff was recommending to some other state goose hunting things, so that put them back another month. Their next meeting is February to consider. I think it's February 10th, 11th. I forget where, but it's sort of their re-notice of intent. And then I believe in March they have sort of what we have what we call the first reading of an ordinance. And then in April they're potentially going to adopt the regulations. So now all of a sudden we're caught behind the eight ball and kind of need to fast track. And do we have Harbor Advisory Board interest in weighing in on the Fish and Game hunting regulations for the Back Bay and making a potential recommendation to the city council?
So, do we have any interest?
Lose.
So, hearing none? Neil?
I'm thinking, I don't know if I have a question.
So, when you say, do we have any interest in what's the interest? What would be the agenda item, or what would we be discussing? Just what the regulations are? For the public, or are we to weigh in on trying to get it changed?
Well, the Fish and Game Commission is hearing what the staff is recommending. For Morro Bay, the staff is currently recommending no changes. There was a proposal presented to Fish and Game from a citizen or citizen group that recommended some changes to the Morro Bay hunting season. They were fairly minimal, some changes to time, and maybe some fewer days and maybe a later start to get it past the Winter Bird Festival. And Fish and Game staff did not recommend that the commission change those. Commission hasn't heard it yet. They haven't considered it yet. They just had the initial notice of intent. So the question for the city of Morro Bay to consider and the council and the Harbor Advisory Board is, would you recommend... would you be wanting to make any recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission in terms of existing regulation, change them, don't change them, entertain the changes that are proposed? So
would this be an agenda item that would be in... Matt? Yes, come on.
When this item came to council, Morro Bay, as you know, we have a component of Morro Bay that folks come here, and they Black Brant and hunting has been important for decades. And we also have a very sizable population of people who are into the birding world. And so that group, the birding world, came to council and expressing their concerns about bird hunting, black brant, especially in the Back Bay. So in terms of what Eric is saying is, coming to Harbor, the advisory board, this would give people on both sides of the equation voice to come and express pro and or con either way, because because this is a part of the Bay, so that's what, as I understand it, as it's come to council, this would give people more a larger voice to come and speak to this.
Dana?
Yeah, this is in state lands area, though, so it's kind of out of our jurisdiction. I mean, I know we're dealing with the state park marina, but we have agreements with them and stuff. It's kind of a different deal. So I don't know. It seems like it's kind of out of our jurisdiction.
Yeah, the state park marina is in the city limits. But
and then actually the island where the largest people go and hunt is, you know, actually right across the bay from where Gene's office is.
Yeah, Grassy Island, but yes. I believe that part is in the city limits.
And so with that, I mean, we have people accessing using, you know, the city property to go and bird hunt, which is a legitimate use and, you know, allowed. And so in terms of that, I mean, one idea that came up, and just for an example, was we had people approach the city, and I think Eric's probably spoken to him, about perhaps talking to the state about not allowing bird hunting on birding weekend. You know, because we have because with the population numbers in Morro Bay coming and using the bay and birding, people are kayaking out there. People are setting up in their, you know, the kayaks and setting out decoys. So it becomes dangerous. So there's kind of a balancing act. But back to I'm not advocating either way.
So basically, you're asking to have the Harbor Advisory Board to operate as a public forum.
Totally.
For and against.
Matt, if you know when, in terms of calendar, when is the brant season?
I think it's starts sometime
10th.
In November.
I'm
and,
sorry?
And a stretch, I think, is it Eric? Eric, it's November to...
Yeah, it's November. The Waterfowl General opens earlier, and then brant opens in the middle of Waterfowl, and then brant closes, and Waterfowl
and
stays there, open. It's November
schedule.
Into January.
And it's if you
But the thing is that if we're going to make any recommendations or have a forum so that the state can even listen, it would have to be in our February meeting, correct? Is that what you're saying?
Well, and it might not work for necessarily for this year. I mean, as Eric's talking about in terms of fish and game, Harbor Board, and I talked to Fish and Game back when this came up a month, and it's a matter of getting on their schedule to come and present. Fish and Game, you know, as me as city council, I'm like, perhaps we could have Fish and Game come and explain the hunting regulations, B, we could talk about a hunting component, what does this entail, and also from the other side, the birding contingent, simply to give voice to everybody's side. Because in Morro Bay, there are groups that this is a completely valid activity on all sides. And so in terms of my envisioning of the advisory purpose is simply to give voice and you as advisory council to hear this as representing the public.
Okay. And to answer your question, Bill, they're set to adopt at their April meeting. I don't know the exact dates. They're going to hear it February, March, and April. It's a three-step process. So we've got time to do it between now and then. Trying to juggle it with Harbor Advisory Board and City Council and when to get it in, I've seen if there's interest in you guys declaring
well,
a future agenda.
Well, from what Matt stated on as a forum for pro and, you know, to hear about what it is, I have some interest, so I'd like to put that on as a future agenda item. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, it sounds to me like a candidate for a special meeting.
No.
It'll dominate the entire agenda for that meeting.
But can't we do it on a meeting where we have a thin agenda?
Well, okay. Well, if that's the case. So is there any interest to have a special meeting for and against and an informative on bird hunting in the Back Bay?
Given that given that this board serves at the pleasure of the city council, and the city council would like this board to serve as a forum to air the issue, whether we have an interest or not, it doesn't make any difference, and I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, okay, they want us to do it, let's do it.
Okay. Well, yeah, Alan?
I'd like to ask Matt a question. Does city council anticipate making a recommendation to Fish and Game?
No, it hasn't. As far as I understand it, and Eric, I don't think this has come up. This issue has been brought up to public comment to city council once, I think, or twice, so there is no actionable items yet. It's still, I'm as city council person, I'm thinking being proactive and going, okay, because the thing is there is some sizable groups of people that, I mean, we have the birding contingent, the bird hunting contingent that comes to town each year, and that's a very sizable group. But then the birding population that comes during January. And so these are very, you know, big and diametrically opposed groups. But however, even if, as Ron was talking about in terms of fast-tracking this, I don't think we could do it justice from city council and or harbor advisory in this short period of time. Let's perhaps put it on the focus, and we start planning for next year. And not necessarily, and this isn't to outlaw anything, but just simply to give it voice.
Okay.
In the February meeting, it would be fine. I don't, not that I don't want to have another special meeting, but the February meeting is, because we've got three-step process. It's not going to be April, and the Fish and Game Commission could change regulations any time in between now and then, so in between the February and April meeting. So the February board meeting is timely enough to get to the council.
Eric, do we have the contacts? I'm sorry, do you mind?
Yeah.
Bill, in terms of having a Fish and Game participant?
Yeah, I've got contacts there. I can certainly.
But I mean, in terms of coming and just presenting what the rules are.
Yeah, I think that'd be valuable.
Okay.
Yeah.
They can do it at the drop of a hat.
So myself and Eric meet on what we're going to have on the agenda, if we have a future agenda item, and if we have all our facts and figures together here. So the first step is, yeah, we need to declare as a future agenda item. Whether we have it in February or in March, that will be determined if we have all the necessary people.
I move that public.
Alan?
It sounds like this meeting we had with the sanctuary the other night, which was not a regular city council meeting, this would not be a regular harbor advisory board.
We have the harbor director wishing that it was not a special meeting.
Well,
I think that's okay.
Right now we're just doing some informative information, and then we'll put the agenda together, whether it be in February or March, if we have all, you know, we have Fish and Game and we have some other people.
So I move that relative to the hunting activity that takes place in Morro Bay, that it be declared as a future agenda item for the Harbor Advisory Board.
Do I have a second to that?
Second.
I have a first and a second. Any discussion? Gene?
Can you add and or a special meeting as opposed to just the Harbor Advisory Board meeting?
Well, that's why I carefully just said future agenda item. Oh, I see. Oh, your point is that means by definition it's a... yes, I'd be happy to amend the motion.
Well,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Gene.
I was going to add that any time the Harbor Advisory Board chair can call for a special meeting. So that if Bill and I through
I understand that, but I think Gene's point was that that this declaration may apply only to a regular meeting.
That's correct.
That was Gene's point. So in recognition of that, I'm amending my motion to include on a regular meeting or a special meeting.
Do you have a resecond on that?
Yes.
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor. We have a second. We have any discussion? Alan? Gene? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Any other future agenda items that need to be brought up? Gene?
Yeah, quite often during our Harbor Advisory Board, things come up as we're just talking, and then we close it, and then we go to future agenda items. We used to have a item which is called additional comments, and I'd like to get that one back on here because somebody on the board during a discussion may think about something they'd like to say, but there's no point, no time, no vehicle for them to say that during our meetings after it's been closed up.
I have no objection to that.
You mean as a regular agenda item?
So it'd be like C7 in today's meeting, right? Okay. Yeah.
Gene, can you bring up an example? Because we're going to potentially run into it's a non-agendized item, and it could lead to discussion, and then...
Well, the additional comments have to be within agenda items on that night. Is that correct, Gene?
No, not necessarily. We have comments in the beginning of our meetings.
Right.
I'm just trying to have something that...
Oh, I see what you mean.
...is at the end there, but right. If that's not acceptable...
Public.
So more for announcements or things that come to mind.
So would it, and I just don't know, so I'm asking, so in terms of the applicable rules of the meetings, could we do that if it did not result in any board action?
Yes.
Is that the way to do
just
it?
Additional comment, a clarification of an item or something
sure,
like that.
Sure.
We have, may I?
Yeah, Dana.
After the Pledge of Allegiance, we have chair and advisory board member announcements and presentations. So couldn't we just have that at the end as additional chair and advisory board member announcements or presentations? Could it be under that or comments or something without it having to be an agenda item that has to be opened up for public comment and on and on and on? It would just be comments.
Exactly, yeah. It just things come up during our discourse of the evening and you think, God, I forgot to say about talk about that. And initially, when we had our public comments, and I'd like to get it out to the public, an announcement or something like that.
Well, we have here already in the beginning. We have it also at the end.
Yeah.
I'll take that into advisement. I'm going to do a little research because we are, as you notice, our agenda already changed, and I probably should have brought that up. We don't have new business, old business. We just have, what are we calling it now?
Business.
Business items. We're following the city council agenda, and all the advisory boards and bodies are now being directed to more closely follow the city council agenda. I still need to conform mine a little more to the council agenda, so I'm going to have to do a little research to see if we can go outside of that box or not.
Thank you, Gene. Okay, any other future agenda items right at this point in time? Hearing none, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Second.
So we have Neil made a motion to adjourn. Dana seconded it. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor? Aye. Thank you.